This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is LifeMint.com, and you're listening to the Mint Editors Podcast with me, Nandita Mathur, and Mint's editor, R. Sukumar. So the first story we talk about is Inside Baba Ramdev's Patanjali Empire, which is a long-form story by Shaunak Mitra, and talks about how he's building a, you know, consumer empire that's up against global giants like Unilever and Colgate.
It's an interesting story because I think it's probably the first time a reporter sort of gotten inside the company, managed to visit the factories, although of course he couldn't speak to Baba Ramdev's brother who runs the operations, who's one of these elusive, reclusive figures who's refusing to meet the media. And because of that, I think it's fairly interesting to see what's happening at this company. There are two or three different strands which I think are very important. The first one, of course, is the entire saleability, for want of a better word, of yoga and Ayurveda. There's this extremely interesting anecdote in the story about a bunch of farmers who've come to meet Ramdev for the early morning yoga session. And each one of them has paid 1,000 to 2,000 rupees, each one of them. Which is a lot for anyone, right? I mean, for a one-hour yoga class or something, or a two-hour yoga session. And towards the end, the Baba's aide and his partner in this whole operation, Acharya Balakrishna, joins him and speaks about Ayurveda and some of their products and all that. The Patanjali Trust, and not the trust so much, but Acharya Balakrishna also owns Astha Channel, on which these yoga sessions are aired, right? So I think it's a very clever way in which they've managed to sell this whole proposition that they have. And it also speaks of the appetite in the market at this point in time, especially among the middle classes, because one would tend to associate, the first tendency is to associate Patanjali with the bottom of the pyramid, slightly right. Low-income households. But that's not the case. If you look at the kind of people who are using it, it's much more of the mainstream middle class that's using it, which also explains why, you know, the sales have risen to 5,000 crores. But that said, again, you'll have to appreciate the fact that there is a gap between what the Baba says and sometimes what happens, because all his products are not manufactured by him. He also practices outsourcing, much like the large packaged consumer goods practice outsourcing.
But the fact that he or his brother, they don't meet the media, does that kind of sort of add to the mystique about them? Because,
well, his brother doesn't meet the media. He meets the media. I mean, at least he's given this lengthy interview to our reporter. Yes, I think the mystique comes from the fact that it's yoga, it's Ayurveda, and then it's consumer products. A lot of the middle class is now becoming increasingly aware about contaminants and pollutants in the products that they buy. They want to buy natural stuff. And here is a man who looks fit. I mean, when you see him doing yoga, his flexibility is amazing. So obviously there's some sort of rub off that's there.
So the next set of stories are on the GDP. So GDP growth figures were announced at 7.9%. And we have a couple of stories. One is on the six charts, which show, you know, the snapshot of the Indian economy. And the other is that how, you know, discrepancies in GDP growth, are they really driving the growth, or and what is this all about?
I think the interesting thing about the six charts, I mean, if I were to put it simply, is just that, sure, there is growth, but a lot of this growth is also there because the corresponding period last year, the base was very low. We did very badly last April. So because of that, what the so-called base effect between last year and this year, obviously the number looks more inflated. But that said, we are still in a better place than many other countries, right? So the fact that India remains a bright spot in a fairly gloomy world, it's quite true. I was speaking to a couple of investment bankers last week, and all of them who used to be moderately negative on India have now turned extremely positive on India. And the reason they say is because it is the only story in the world right now. So the second part, which is really the discrepancies, is interesting because you have the supply side numbers and then you have the expenditure side numbers. And I don't think we have a lot of visibility on the expenditure side numbers. Mm-hmm. And when you don't have the visibility, which means you don't know where to put the numbers, they're put under a head called discrepancies. Now, I'm quite willing to buy the government's explanation, although there hasn't been an official explanation on social media. There's been some comment by some people associated with the government. I'm quite willing to buy the explanation that there's no dodginess about these numbers. But that said, I think the CSO, which is the agency that puts out these numbers, has some responsibility in explaining these numbers. Because the minute you have discrepancies at such a significant proportion of growth, people want to know what expenditure category is really contributing. And then you find out that it's discrepancies that's contributing. You don't really know what's ticking and what's not. Right. But like I said, that said, things are good. We're still better off than many other places in the world.
And if you combine the forecast of a good monsoon along with that, then things probably look even better.
That's right. I think the IMD has been extremely bullish in its forecast. Right. There's no reason to assume that it will go wrong. I hope for everyone's sake that it is correct. Across the country, they've predicted a monsoon which is going to be in excess of normal, except the Northeast. And extremely good for the agrarian economy and the rural economy, which drives the rural economy, of course, drives the sales of many packaged goods, motorcycles and scooters, mm-hmm. even some consumer durables, televisions and so on. Because there have been 2 years of deficient rains, there have been 2 years of drought. There is a significant agrarian crisis, which has also partly been brought about by the collapse of the global commodity super cycle. Prices have come down, of not just metals and other things that go into manufacturing, but also food stuff. And that's really hit the farmers very hard. So the monsoon will mean a good crop. It will mean higher confidence. It will mean more sales for a variety of products. And obviously, it will mean no drought. So you know, these horror stories you have, and a few weeks ago we were discussing many stories we'd done on the drought, cattle dying by the thousands in Bundelkhand and all that. I think that will come to an end.
Right. So monsoon also has an impact on inflation and interest rates besides the agrarian economy. So overall it should do good.
Yes, but you know, inflation seems to be picking up a little bit. My own sense is this is probably one of those transitory effects that is brought about by a variety of reasons. And I have a feeling that RBI, the Reserve Bank of India, when it meets next week, will also probably take this view and hold its hand. Because I think inflation is not as big a problem as it was a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But that said, I don't think, especially given that growth seems to be picking up, I don't think RBI is going to cut rates anymore. It'll probably pause and see what happens.
So another story that you've picked is Tamal's story, How Many Banks Are Swimming Naked? I mean, the headline itself was pretty catchy, and the story itself talks about how, you know, the fears of a banking sector collapse may be exaggerated. But then banks also needn't be in a denial mode about it.
Correct. I think it's very important that banks not be in denial. They are in trouble. And of course, part of the reason why they are in trouble is because some of the projects they have loaned money to have been delayed for reasons beyond the control of the promoters or the developers of those projects, and obviously the banks. Mm. Raw material issues, environmental approvals, other approvals from the government, land acquisition issues, all of that. So sure, that is one issue. Mm. But as this government works towards clearing the roadblocks, and it has been working on clearing the roadblocks, in roads, for instance, many of the projects that have held up are now well on their way to completion. I think the roads ministry has been extremely successful in doing that. But that said, the banks have also been fairly indiscreet and imprudent in loaning money to all sorts of people. They've been very rash in terms of throwing good money after bad. When they know that a promoter or a developer is in trouble, they've just gone out and loaned more money. There has been no sort of collaboration between banks. So a promoter who's in deep trouble with one bank has always found it easy to borrow money from another bank. Right. I mean, not now. Now, of course, everyone finds it difficult to borrow money, but I'm speaking about the boom years,
right,
which have resulted in the crisis that you see in banks. And I think for banks, it's a good time to introspect. It's a good time to change some of these practices. It's a good time to reduce corruption in banks, to reduce political influence, and make their lending practices more prudent.
Should they also sort of avoid certain sectors like, you know, steel, etc.?
I'm not one of those people who thinks that, you know, you should avoid any sector. I think they should lend based on the risk profile of the borrower. They should lend based on the economic viability of the project, and they should lend also based on corporate governance norms and how well they think this person is, will manage the project. Right. And when you look at many of the cases where there have been issues, the most the headline story, of course, being Kingfisher, which is at the end of the day a small proportion. I mean, it's 9,000 crores odd. There are people, including many of the big conglomerates like SR and Reliance Communications, the Anilamani Group, which owe much more, or JP. Or DLF, or GMR, or GVK. But when you look at Kingfisher, you will find that the banks are in trouble because they ignored many of the prudential norms. Right. I think it was in 2012, for instance, if I have my ear right, that they did a debt-equity switch, transferred some amount of debt into equity at a huge premium. It was a sweetheart deal for Malia. Who did it? A consortium of banks led by SBI, the State Bank of India, which is now going after Kingfisher. Now, why did they do it? While as much as you can blame other people for their problems, I think the malaise is internal. They have to blame themselves too.
So there's an e-commerce story again today, which is on Flipkart and Snapdeal seeing falling sales despite internet users in India increasing. And this is an offshoot from the Mary Meeker report, which was just released yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, the number of internet users in India have gone up, but our story says they don't seem to be paying, which is true. I mean, it's a nice catchy way of putting it, but I guess it's true. And the reason it's true is because last year and the year before, and all of us are aware of it, many of the e-commerce marketplaces grew sales on the back of huge discounts.
Correct.
To such an extent that I think last year it was that we had, I think it was last year that we had a story that pointed out that consumers were no longer interested in 30% discounts and 40% discounts, and we're looking at discounts in excess of 60% and 70%. You could get, I mean, I know of someone in the newsroom who bought a printer for like 7 rupees. He says it still works. And I think that sort of encouraged people to sort of go overboard. And why did many of the e-commerce companies do it? Well, of course, Amazon did it because it was building market share. And I think Amazon has by far been the most efficient and most professional of e-commerce marketplaces in India because it's focused on consumer delivery. But that's a different story. Yeah. But if you look at the Indian e-commerce companies, Flipkart and Snapdeal, I think they grew sales because what they call gross merchandise value, which is not really sales, because gross merchandise value is total value, includes returns, includes all sorts of things, is linked to their valuation. So, right, I mean, you obviously have to show a high GMV to get more valuation, which means you grow GMV at all cost. And clearly, as the discounts have dried up, because over the, especially since the second half of 2015, I think the investors in these companies have sort of tightened the purse strings. They have told these companies to focus on profitability and efficiency, and the companies are beginning to do that, which means discounts are not happening as frequently as they used to. And then, of course, you have the recent government norm for marketplaces, which also says that you can't really offer these disproportionate discounts. There's still not too much clarity on what the government means. The companies also don't seem very clear on this. And I personally believe the government has no business in telling people at what price they can sell. Right? I mean, if a pension fund in California wants to subsidize a printer that someone in my newsroom is buying, I have no problem with it. I don't see why the government should have a problem with it. But the drying up of discounts for these two reasons has meant that people are not buying as much as they were buying at these e-commerce companies, and that's evident in the sales. I'm told that the April sales are lower than the December sales.
So clearly e-commerce is in a state of turmoil, maybe.
Yeah, I would call it churn. I wouldn't call it turmoil, because I think the long-term prospects still remain. I mean, who wants to go out in the summer heat, in all this traffic? and of course, if you're in smaller cities, you don't even have access to a lot of these products. So the reasons why you have to buy, which is convenience, speed of delivery, customer service, ease of buying, all of those remain.
So finally, we wrap up with this story on Infosys and how it paid its outgoing CFO a whopping, you know, 23 crore as a severance package.
I mean, it's the kind of money that even its CEO is not supposed to get according to the terms of contract. And I don't think, I mean, from the information we have, because Infosys has been particularly cagey about it. I mean, it's supposed to be an extremely transparent company, but I've always noticed that with Infosys, when the issue is slightly touchy and controversial, they clam up just the way the most traditional promoter-run company in India clams up. So the board has been very opaque about this. We do not know whether there was a severance contract. We do not know why he was paid so much. And that is worrying, right? I mean, you want to know why that much money is being paid. Was there something wrong in the company? I'm not saying there was, but what was it? Was it hush money, which is, you know, money paid to him to keep quiet? Was it money paid to him because he knows the company's plans and they don't want him to work for a few more years? I mean, in which case there should be a non-compete. It doesn't seem like there was a non-compete in his terms of agreement. Or was he just being rewarded for the great work he'd done in Infosys, helping the company turn around? And they felt that, listen, we have to reward him in some way. It could have been any of these, but what, right?
So the unexplained sum sort of raised more questions.
Communication is very important. There used to be a time in the 90s when Infosys was by far one of the best communicators in the industry. Mm-hmm. But right now, I don't think that's the case.
So those were Sukumar's top stories for this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at LiveMint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. Thank you for listening and see you next Friday.